content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 3rd, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. U.S. Special Forces flee Yemen's chaos. What happened? Yemen was engulfed in a full-blown civil war this week, forcing the U.S. to suspend crucial anti-terrorism operations there, as Houthi rebels began an assault on Aden, the last stronghold of Yemeni government. Beleaguered President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi reportedly fled the country by sea. The Iranian-backed militants have been in control of Yemen's capital, Sana'a, since September. And as they advanced south last weekend, they also seized control of the country's third-largest city, Taiz. During that advance, the U.S. pulled its team of around 100 Special Forces troops out of the southern Al Anad air base, where they had been gathering intelligence for drone strikes against the Yemen-based group Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. Houthi forces then seized the base. In response to the chaos and amid fears over Iran's growing regional influence, Saudi Arabia amassed heavy artillery on its border with Yemen. The Houthi rebels, who practice a variant of Shiite Islam, are receiving support from Iran's Shiite government and are also working with security forces still loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, the longtime Shiite president who was ousted in 2012. Adding to the turmoil, a group claiming allegiance to the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria claimed responsibility for suicide attacks that killed 137 Shiite worshippers in Sana'a last Friday. If the claims are true, it was the terror organization's first attack in Yemen. On Wednesday, Yemeni Foreign Minister Riyad Yassin pleaded for help from other nations, urging allies to send fighter jets, navies, and ground forces if necessary. What the editorial said: another week, another victory for disorder in the Middle East, said the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. withdrawal from Yemen is a major loss in the fight against AQAP, the Al-Qaeda group most focused on hitting the U.S. mainland. We still have nearby military bases and warships from which to launch attacks on terrorists, but the lack of ground forces will reduce accurate targeting. Only last September, President Obama hailed his Yemen strategy, drone attacks on targets identified by special forces, as a model for other anti-terrorism operations. That wishful thinking has now been exposed. Yemen now faces an Iraq-Libya-Syria scenario with warring factions but no central government, said The Economist. Hadi hopes to return to power, but he cannot realistically hope to win a war against the Houthis and Saleh. So he is now waiting for Saudi Arabia or other Gulf nations to intervene and restore his rule, which is unlikely. But the Houthis also lack legitimacy to rule all of Yemen. After their illegal seizure of Sana'a in September, they agreed to share power with Hadi and withdraw from the capital. What the columnist said: Yemen is obviously a public relations disaster for Team Obama, said Peter Brooks in the Boston Herald. It's also a huge strategic distraction when we're already facing major challenges in Iraq, Syria, Iran, Afghanistan, and Ukraine. And the U.S. role in Yemen will be limited. The civil war is just a proxy for the Middle East's newest great game. Saudi Arabia's Sunni leaders fighting for dominance in a region with the Shiite mullahs of Iran. This will be a protracted civil war with multiple protagonists, said Brian Whitaker in TheGuardian.com. Former President Saleh will be a key player, despite having constantly battled with the Houthis during his 34-year rule. The opportunistic Shiite leader formed an unlikely alliance with the group in a bid to return to power and install his son as president. That ambition will continue to be an obstacle to resolving this crisis. AQAP appears to be in position to gain the most from the turmoil in Yemen, said Martin Reardon in AlJazeera.com. Counterterrorism experts consider it to be the most dangerous terrorist organization in the world because of its determination to devise and plant undetectable bombs on airliners or other Western targets. If there's a power vacuum in large parts of the country, AQAP will be much freer to operate, and they'll be bigger, stronger, and better. For America and Europe, that's a very alarming prospect. The controversy of the week. 5 years on, is Obamacare working? When President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law in March 2010, an open microphone famously caught Vice President Joe Biden calling it a big effing deal, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. 5 years later, there's little doubt that Biden was entirely correct. Despite Republican predictions that the ACA would be a catastrophic failure, the law, now universally known as Obamacare, has extended insurance coverage to 16.4 million previously uninsured Americans, and its cost-saving measures actually helped to rein in overall U.S. healthcare spending. Healthcare costs rose only 3.6% in 2013, the lowest increase since 1960. This week, the Congressional Budget Office revised the projected 10-year cost of the law down to $1.2 trillion, 11% less than last year's estimate. As for the ACA's supposed job-killing impact, 2014 was the best year for job creation since the 90s. Even though the doomsayers have been wrong pretty much across the board, said Jonathan Bernstein in BloombergView.com, polls indicate that the law remains unpopular. Only 40% support it, while 45% oppose it. People oppose Obamacare because they are feeling for themselves the law's impact, said Grace Marie Turner in Forbes.com. It forced millions of Americans to give up doctors and cheaper insurance plans they liked. Plans purchased through Obamacare are deceptively costly, with huge deductibles averaging $5,081 for individuals in the cheaper bronze plans, 42% more than average deductibles in plans sold outside the exchanges. As for the claim that Obamacare has slowed healthcare inflation, the law supporters seldom mention that the slowdown began before the ACA was signed as an effect of the recession, and that the rate is projected to start climbing again next year. The CBO's initial estimate was that 26 million Americans would gain coverage under the ACA by 2015, said Jeffrey H. Anderson in WeeklyStandard.com. In what universe is failing to hit a target by 10 million people working even better than anticipated? Obamacare is hardly perfect, said Sarah Cliff in Vox.com. But opinion polls are not a good measure of its effectiveness. Thanks to a relentless campaign of misinformation by conservative critics, the public remains shockingly ignorant of the law's effects. In a recent Vox.com poll, for instance, only 60% were aware that Obamacare has increased the number of Americans with health insurance, and just 5% knew that projections of Obamacare's 10-year cost have consistently fallen. More than 3 in 4 Americans either think the program is providing insurance to undocumented immigrants or aren't sure if it does, even though the ACA expressly bars coverage to such immigrants. Republican lies may be soiling Obamacare's reputation, said Ron Fournier in NationalJournal.com. But Democratic lies sold it in the first place. Obama falsely promised that if you like your health plan, you can keep it, period, and downplayed the fact that his health care plan redistributes wealth to the poor. Obamacare carries such an enduring stigma because it's an ugly reflection of today's political culture. Though the law is largely succeeding in its goal, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com, the state of Obamacare debate is depressing. The ACA has become a central symbol in our country's bitter debate over the role of government. So no amount of factual information will change the minds of either liberals or conservatives. 5 years on, the hardening of opinion is, if anything, worse. And it was a good week for seducing carnivores after Burger King said it would sell a $40 cologne that smells like a Whopper at select locations in Japan. Flamed Grill will be available on April 1st, Burger King said, an indication that it may all be an April Fool's joke. It was a good week for law and order after a Virginia condo complex announced that all dogs must undergo DNA testing so that any unscooped poop can be traced to its owner, who will be fined up to $500. And it was a good week for flexibility after Republican presidential candidate Senator Ted Cruz, who says Obamacare is a disaster, lost his family health insurance and began shopping for a policy through Obamacare. I believe we should follow the text of every law, Cruz says. It was a bad week for crossing the boss when White House florist Laura Dowling was fired and escorted from the building after reportedly clashing with Michelle Obama, who did not like her fussy style. It was a bad week for Rocky Mountain Highs after laboratory testing found that legal weed sold in Colorado is often contaminated with fungus and the chemical butane and has little or no cannabidiol, or CBD, the compound that makes medical marijuana medical. And it was a bad week for hasty diagnoses after a New York woman sued a psychiatric hospital that allegedly deemed her delusional because she told doctors that President Obama followed her on Twitter. Obama does follow Cam Brock, along with more than 640,000 other people. Obama follows positive people, Brock said. On the briefing page this week, fouling Mount Everest. Littered with discarded equipment, corpses, and human excrement, the world's highest mountaintop is now a dump. Why is Everest so dirty? Everest has gone from being the ultimate challenge for the most skilled mountaineers to a bucket list item for adventure seekers. Every year, hundreds of climbers try to scale the 29,029-foot peak, and this huge influx of climbers has left its once pristine slopes covered in garbage, discarded equipment, and human waste. A recent report by Grinnell College estimated that 12 tons of feces are left on the mountain each year, either buried in the snow around the four camps near the peak, or deposited in rudimentary toilets that are emptied near water supplies further down. An estimated 50 tons of garbage, from broken tent frames to used oxygen canisters to food wrappers, are strewn along the route up the mountain, along with many of the frozen, half-buried corpses of the more than 200 climbers who have perished attempting the ascent. Little wonder the mountain has earned the nickname World's Highest Garbage Dump. Is anyone trying to clean it up? Last year, the Nepali government began requiring each climber to bring back at least 17.6 pounds of trash or lose his or her $4,000 deposit, although there are questions about how strictly that rule is enforced. Several expedition companies organize voluntary cleanup trips and offer Sherpas, the local mountain guides, cash rewards for bringing down extra rubbish. In 2013, a joint Indo-Nepali Army expedition collected an impressive 4.4 tons of trash in just 6 weeks. More than half was classified as biohazardous waste. Sherpas are now finding less trash to bring back, which suggests cleanup efforts are working. But there is no way to say how much garbage is still left, says veteran guide Dawa Stephen, Sherpa. It is impossible to say what is under the ice. How many people climb Everest? More than 4,400 climbers have reached the peak since Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa, Tenzing Norgay, first summited it in 1953, most of them very recently. In 2013 alone, Everest was climbed by 658 people during the yearly two-month climbing window in the spring. The previous year, 234 climbers reached the peak on a single day. As a result, the top of the world has a serious overcrowding problem. Long lines form below the toughest climbing spots, and Sherpas have even considered erecting a ladder to ease congestion at the Hillary Step, the iconic final obstacle before the summit. Climbing Everest, says mountaineer and author Graham Hoyland, isn't a wilderness experience. It's a McDonald's experience. Who are all these climbers? Many of them are tourists, not true mountaineers. Sherpas spend weeks before each climbing season setting up ropes, ladders, and other equipment along the route to make it easier to ascend. As a result, anyone with a bit of training and in decent shape can climb Everest, provided, of course, they pay from $30,000 to $100,000 per person to an expedition company. Advances in equipment and weather forecasting have also significantly improved success rates. In 1990, only 18% of climbers made it to the top. By 2012, it was 56%. While the Nepali government has encouraged this dramatic influx, it makes more than $3 million a year from the $11,000 a head climbing permits. Overcrowding on steep slopes, 20,000 or 25,000 feet high, carries very real dangers. What sort of dangers? When climbers have to stand in line for as long as 2 hours, they waste precious body heat and valuable oxygen supplies. Larger groups usually have to be roped together, meaning if one person falls and the safety ropes fail, everyone else goes down too. For Sherpas, who spend so much time on the mountain preparing the routes, the risk is heightened. Last year, an avalanche on the notoriously dangerous Khumbu Icefall killed 16 Sherpas, the deadliest accident in Everest's history. The Nepali government's underwhelming response to the tragedy, offering the victims' families just $400 each in compensation, prompted the Sherpas to end the climbing season early and sparked a debate on their pay and working conditions. But in a region where the only real alternative to mountaineering work is subsistence farming, the stakes are high. No mountaineering means no tourists, Nima Doma Sherpa, the wife of one of the victims, told the Wall Street Journal. No tourists means no jobs. How can Everest be made safer? Nepali officials have changed the route up the mountain this season to avoid the treacherous Khumbu Icefall. There have been calls for all Sherpas to be given an avalanche beacon, a $300 device that helps rescuers find buried climbers. ultimately climbing the world's highest peak with its deep crevasses and fragile ice towers will always be a dangerous pursuit. But despite the risk, not to mention the garbage, there will never be a shortage of willing adventurers. I don't think Everest has that sense of the unknown anymore, says British climber Adele Pennington. But it still has that majesty. There is still something about standing on top of the world. Sushi and white wine, please. During their historic ascent of Everest, Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay survived on sardines, dates, and tinned apricots. Today's climbers can pay to enjoy a much higher degree of luxury while conquering nature. At base camp, 17,598 feet up the mountain, high-end expeditions offer yoga classes, sushi, and bars fully stocked with wine, beer, and liquor. On the peak, there is even enough cell reception for climbers to send a celebratory tweet. When last year's tragic Khumbu icefall avalanche left a section of the mountain all but impassable, a wealthy Chinese businesswoman provoked uproar by paying for a helicopter to ferry her and her team of Sherpas above the accident site. Before his death in 2008, Hillary himself lamented the commercialization of Everest. Having people pay $65,000 and then be led up the mountain by a couple of experienced guides, he said in 2003, isn't really mountaineering at all. And we'll take a look at the columns now. First two from the U.S. This comes from the Washington Post. Author is Hans Benedict. What war with Iran would look like? If the U.S. does not reach a nuclear agreement with Iran, says Hans Benedict, war may be inevitable. But Americans should be clear-eyed about what that would mean. Before the U.S. could launch any airstrikes on Iran's multiple nuclear complexes, it would first have to take out the country's air force and sophisticated air defense systems. Such an operation could require hundreds of sorties over several days. Tehran would respond by attacking oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, potentially triggering a global oil crisis, and by launching terrorist attacks on American interests around the world. These attacks would fuel outrage in America and demands for regime change. Ousting Iran's leaders would require yet another ground war in the Middle East, this time with a nation of 80 million people. Thousands of Americans could die in fighting that would go on for years. None of this means we should rule out war with Iran if negotiations fail and Tehran does attempt to build nuclear weapons. But war must be a last resort. Sugarcoating its consequences does no one any favors. From Tom Krattenmaker at USA Today, the Pope's Climate Change Challenge. If you thought Pope Francis was already making Catholic Republicans mighty uncomfortable, says Tom Krattenmaker, wait until he issues his encyclical on climate change. The popular Pope aggravated conservatives when he strongly criticized economic inequality and the excesses of capitalism. But he will really challenge their worldview this summer with an official statement on the moral need to act on climate change. A Christian who does not protect creation, Francis has said, is a Christian who does not care about the work of God. His encyclical will portray global warming as a reality with dire moral implications, especially for the poor and vulnerable who are at the heart of Catholic social teaching. His call to action may sway people who are on the fence, and it will present a real challenge to the many Republican leaders who are Catholic, including House Speaker John Boehner and the possible presidential candidates Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. As evidence of climate change mounts, there are reports that some congressional Republicans are looking for an excuse to admit that the world has a problem. Who better than the widely respected Pope to provide one? And an international column, India raising a generation of cheats. The shocking image of parents clambering up a school building in the city of Hajipur and passing test answers through the windows to their children has shamed India, said the Financial Express in an editorial. The greater shame, though, is that authorities in Bihar state say there is nothing they can do to stop it. Days after the photo went viral on the internet, the cheating was still going on. Police tried to turn back crowds of relatives at exam sites, and some officers fired their guns into the air as a warning, but they had to retreat when parents pelted them with rocks. Bihar officials have expelled hundreds of students, but lamely say they can't end the epidemic without the cooperation of students and parents. Don't blame the Bihari students, said Manoj Kumar in firstpost.com. Education is vitally important in this impoverished rural state, where more than half of the population is under 25. Yet students can't learn the material needed to pass the matriculation exam because Bihari teachers are themselves poorly educated. One quarter of all teachers recently failed a test with very simple questions, such as which part of the potato is eaten and what is 20 plus 5. These incompetents come from the massive recruitment drive of 2005, when Bihar realized it needed tens of thousands of teachers to serve the surging youth population and promptly hired anyone with a high school diploma. But Bihar has always had a culture of cheating, said the Times of India. From the 1960s to the 1990s, exams were like carnival time, when thousands of people camped out around the schools. Each student had a team to help, an older male relative to supervise, a sprightly kid who could scurry fast into the school and fetch the paper, and somebody smart to actually answer the test questions. The students simply sat in the exam room and waited for the answers. That system was supposed to have been reformed, but apparently, organized cheating is still deeply entrenched. It's not just Bihar State, said Abhishek Saha in Hindustan Times. Cheating is endemic in India. Can any of us honestly say we have never hidden chits in socks or copied from the adjacent students' answers? Last week in Odisha State, high school students locked their principal in his office when he refused to allow them to cheat. In Uttar Pradesh and West Bengal, students routinely bribe teachers and break school surveillance cameras so they can copy freely. What we need to change is the entire concept of Indian exams, which are based on rote memorization. Many other countries use open book exams in which students apply knowledge rather than regurgitating facts. If we continue to tolerate blatant cheating, our children might take to committing graver offenses when they grow up. And we turn now to the last word, our in-depth article, titled, Baked Alaska. If Alaska is the canary in our climate coal mine, said Eric Holthaus, the planet is in trouble. Earlier this winter, Monica Zappa packed up her crew of Alaskan sled dogs and headed south in search of snow. We haven't been able to train where we live for 2 months, she told me. Alaska's Kenai Peninsula, which Zappa calls home, was practically tropical this winter. Rick Tolman, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Alaska, has been dumbfounded. Homer, Alaska keeps setting record after record, and I keep looking at the data like, Has the temperature sensor gone out or something? Something does seem to be going on in Alaska. Last fall, a skipjack tuna, which is more likely to be found in the Galapagos than near a glacier, was caught about 150 miles southeast of Anchorage, not far from the Kenai. A few weeks ago, race organizers had to truck in snow to the ceremonial Iditarod start line in Anchorage. Alaska is heating up at twice the rate of the rest of the country, a canary in our climate coal mine. A new report shows that warming in Alaska, along with the rest of the Arctic, is accelerating as the loss of snow and ice cover begins to set off a feedback loop of further warming. Warming in wintertime has been the most dramatic, more than 6 degrees in the past 50 years. And this is just a fraction of the warming that's expected to come over just the next few decades. Of course, it's not just Alaska. This February was the most extreme on record in the lower 48, and it marked the first time that two large sections of territory, each more than 30% of the country, experienced both exceptional cold and exceptional warmth in the same month, according to the data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. All-time records were set for the coldest month in dozens of eastern cities, with Boston racking up more snow than the peaks of California's Sierra Nevada. A single January storm in Boston produced more snow than Anchorage saw all winter. Alaska is on the front lines of climate change. This year's Iditarod was rerouted twice because of the warm weather. The race traditionally starts in Anchorage, which had near-record low snowfall this winter. The city was without a single significant snowstorm between October and late January, so race organizers decided to move the start from the Anchorage area 360 miles north to Fairbanks. But when the Chenal River, which was supposed to be part of the new route's first few miles, failed to sufficiently freeze, the starting point had to move again to another location in Fairbanks. On March 9th, Zappa set out with her dogs on the 1,000-mile race across Alaska as one of 78 mushers in this year's Iditarod. For most of the winter, the weather across the interior of the state had been abnormally warm. To train, many teams of dogs and their owners had to travel, often outside, away from Alaska. Zappa ended up going to the mountains of Wyoming. A recent study said that Alaska's rivers and melting glaciers are now outputting more water than the Mississippi River. Last year was Alaska's warmest on record, and the warm weather has continued right on into 2015. This winter, Anchorage essentially transformed into a less sunny version of Seattle. As of March 9th, the city had received less than one-third of its normal amount of snow. In its place, rain. Lots of rain. In fact, schools in the Anchorage area are now more likely to cancel school because of rain and street flooding than because of cold and snow. Of course, it wasn't always this way. Alaska's recent surge of back-to-back warm winters comes after a record snowy 2012, when the National Guard was employed to help dig out buried towns. Then, about 2 years ago, something in the climate system switched. The state's recent brush with extreme weather is more than just year-to-year weather variability. Alaska is at the point where the long-term trend of warming has begun to trump seasonal weather fluctuations. A recent shift toward warmer offshore ocean temperature is essentially adding more fuel to the fire, moving the state toward profound tipping points like irreversible loss of permafrost, and increasingly violent weather. If the current warm ocean phase, which began in 2014, holds for a decade or so, as is typical, Alaska will quickly become a different place. The Pacific Ocean near Alaska has been record warm for months now. This year is off to a record wet start in Juneau. Kodiak experienced its warmest winter on record. A record burst of ocean warmth has affected statewide weather before, but this time feels different, residents say. In late February, National Weather Service employees spotted thunder snow in Nome, a city just 100 miles south of the Arctic Circle. As far as I know, that's unprecedented, Thoman told me. Thunderstorms of any kind require a level of atmospheric energy that's rarely present in cold climates. To get that outside of the summer is incredibly rare everywhere, let alone in Alaska. Climate scientists are starting to link the combination of melting sea ice and warm ocean temperatures to shifts in the jet stream. For the past few winters, those shifts have brought surges of tropical moisture toward southern Alaska via potent atmospheric rivers. This weather pattern has endured so long, it's even earned its own name, the Ridiculously Resilient Ridge. The persistent area of high pressure stretching from Alaska to California has shunted wintertime warmth and moisture northward into the Arctic, while the eastern half of the continent is plunged into a deep freeze, polar vortex style. The warm water is making its way north to the Arctic Ocean, too, where as of early March, sea ice levels were at their record lowest for the date. The resurgent heating of the Pacific, we're officially in an El Nino year now, is also expected to give a boost to global warming over the next few years by releasing years of pent-up oceanic energy into the atmosphere, pushing even more warm water toward the north, melting Alaska from all sides. That means Alaska's weather, according to one Alaska meteorologist, is broken. Dave Snyder, who reports statewide weather daily for the National Weather Service's Alaska office in Anchorage, tweeted the sentiment back in mid-January. Snyder emphasized that this isn't the official view of the National Weather Service, of course. Snyder told me he had made the comment sort of in jest, but pointed to the nearly snow-free Iditarod start as evidence. Here's another example he could have used. In early November, Super Typhoon Nuri morphed into a huge post-tropical cyclone, passing through the Aleutians very near Shemya Island on its way to becoming Alaska's strongest storm on record. Despite winds near 100 miles per hour, Shemya emerged relatively unscathed. A few days later, the remnants of that storm actually altered the jet stream over much of the continent, ushering in a highly amplified omega block pattern that dramatically boosted temperatures across the state and sent wave after wave of Arctic cold toward the East Coast. Barrow was briefly warmer than Dallas or Atlanta. The warm weather isn't all bad news. The city of Anchorage has saved an estimated $1 million on snow removal this year and is instead pouring that money into fixing potholes and other backlogged maintenance issues. But getting around the rest of the state hasn't been so easy. There are few roads in rural Alaska, so winter travel is often done by snowmobiles over frozen rivers. Not this year. Warm temperatures in February led to thin ice and open water in the southwest part of the state, near Galena and Bethel. David Hewlin, managing editor for the Alaska Dispatch News in Anchorage, has spent nearly 30 years in the state. He says the freeze-thaw cycle is out of whack, changing the nature of the place. Usually things freeze in the fall and unfreeze in the spring. This winter they've seen a nearly constant back and forth between freezing and thawing. That's made it difficult for skiers and those enjoying other outdoor activities, like riding fat tire bikes attuned to the snow. Julie Sidoris of Bike Me Anchorage Meetup says attendance in her group was down this winter. Hulin agrees that it's been frustrating. I mean, what's living in Alaska if it's not cold and snowy? Those are city problems. Along the state's west coast, some native coastal villages are facing an existential threat as sea levels rise in response to the warm water. Earlier this winter, Washington Post climate reporter Chris Mooney visited Kivalina, one of the six villages considering plans to relocate because of climate change. Here, climate change is less a future threat and more a daily force, felt in drastic changes to weather, loss of traditional means of sustenance like whale hunting, and the literal vanishing of land, Mooney wrote. Another village, Nutok, is a bit further along in the relocation process, with construction on their new village, Mertavik, already underway. For now, the most visible change is still in the shifting habitats of the fish, birds, trees, and animals. Permafrost still covers 85% of the state, but almost everywhere, the depth of the active layer is increasing over the last few decades, said Tauman. Since the active layer, the zone of soil above the permafrost that thaws out each summer, now penetrates deeper down, that means landforms are shifting, lakes are draining, and new forests are springing up. Patricia Owen is a biologist at Denali National Park and Preserve who studies grizzly bears. Last winter, warm weather brought blueberry blossoms earlier than normal. The blossoms then froze, making foraging for food more challenging for bears. Mother bears need to have good health in the fall to support their cubs during the long winter months of hibernation. Owen is seeing evidence of other changes within Denali. More episodes of freezing rain are having a big impact on sheep, which have to scrape through ice to eat. In low snow years like this one, wolves seem to suffer, since caribou and moose can escape more quickly. Recent warming also appears to have pushed Denali's poplar forest across a threshold toward rapid expansion. Carl Rowland, a Denali plant ecologist who has compiled a trove of repeat photographs around the park, spanning decades of environmental change, says that what he's seeing is dramatic. Once the permafrost goes, Rowland says, we can expect a regime shift in the park and across the state. The northward spread of tree-killing insects is also a really big unknown in interior Alaska. Last spring, a huge forest fire in a beetle kill area of Kenai Peninsula sent smoke plumes hundreds of miles northward toward Fairbanks. For southern Alaska, fire season has been coming earlier in recent years, and in 2015 looks to be no exception. A few years ago, the Alaska Division of Forestry statutorily moved the start of the fire season up from May 1st to April 1st. As a result of climate change. Tim Mowry, a division spokesman, told me, the change, Mowry says, was intended to elicit a sense of urgency. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Slate.com. The Health and Science page takes us to the other side of the globe with a similar article. It says, another melting Antarctic glacier. The warming of the world's ocean is causing a glacier the size of California in East Antarctica to melt, and scientists fear its collapse could eventually cause global sea levels to rise by as much as 11 feet. The Totten Glacier was long thought to be stable and isolated from the warm water currents that are degrading ice sheets in West Antarctica. But recent observations have shown that the glacier is thinning by a very rapid 33 feet a year. To find out why, an international team of scientists carried out an extensive aerial survey of the glacier using planes fitted with ice-penetrating radar. They discovered two massive undersea valleys beneath the ice sheet, one of which is 3 miles wide. Those canyons allow warm, salty water sitting on the ocean floor. The salt makes it heavier than the frigid waters above, to reach the glacier's base, causing it to melt from below. If the glacier were to vanish completely, oceans around the world would rise by at least 11 feet, on top of the 1 to 3 foot rise the United Nations already expects by 2100. While the Totten melt may take several centuries, study author Jameen Greenbaum tells CNN.com, once change has begun, our analysis reveals it would likely be irreversible. The toll of loneliness. Too much time alone can kill you. That's the conclusion of a study from Brigham Young University, which found that isolation and loneliness are as bad for a person's health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day or being an alcoholic. Researchers examined data from 35 years worth of studies on loneliness, and after accounting for participants' socioeconomic status, age, gender, and pre-existing health conditions, they discovered that people who feel lonely have a 26% greater risk of premature death. Living alone or being socially isolated is even more damaging to a person's health, increasing the risk of early death by roughly 30%. The BYU team believes the U.S. will see soaring numbers of loneliness-related health problems in the near future because more people than ever are living alone. We are predicting a possible loneliness epidemic, the study's co-author Tim Smith tells ScienceDaily.com. The health scare of the week is diet soda's fatty downside. Diet soda may not have the sugar and calories found in regular soft drinks, but people who drink it daily often wind up with fatter stomachs. A study in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society followed 749 people ages 65 and over for 9 years and found that regular diet soda drinkers gained nearly 3 times as much belly fat as those who didn't touch the beverage. Expanding waistlines are particularly worrisome because belly fat is associated with an increased risk of chronic health issues like heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Scientists are still puzzling over why diet sodas are associated with weight gain. It could be that people who switch to low-calorie soda think that means they can have an extra slice of pizza or a candy bar, says study lead author Sharon Fowler of the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. Those people might end up consuming more calories than if they just had a regular soda. Alternatively, Fowler speculates, the high acidity of diet soda could kill off certain gut microbes, changing how the body processes food. Calorie-free, she tells Reuters.com, does not equal consequences free. And on the talking points page, mandatory voting. Would it work in the U.S.? There are two types of people in our country, said John Wellington Innist in HuffingtonPost.com. Those that want everyone's voice to count, and those that don't. Last week, President Obama proved he was in the first camp. Asked how to offset the influence of big money in politics, he suggested introducing mandatory voting. Citing the system in Australia, where the threat of fines for not voting has increased turnout to 95%, Obama said requiring everyone to vote would be transformative for American politics. This wasn't an official policy proposal, but it should be. With a record low participation of 36% in the 2014 and widespread voter disenfranchisement, American democracy is anemic. Decisions affecting the entire country should involve the entire country. What is this, the Soviet Union? Asks John Fund in NationalReview.com. The Soviets and Saddam Hussein's Iraq also had mandatory voting. In the U.S., where we have the freedom of speech, not voting can send a message just as much as voting. Obama's interest in mandatory voting is obvious. He himself said non-voters tend to be young, poor, and skewed more heavily toward immigrant groups and minority groups. In other words, Democrats. It's hard to see why mandatory voting would reduce election spending, said Karen Klein in Los Angeles Times. Reaching so many voters would surely require more expensive TV ads and campaign staff. Plus, forcing people to vote wouldn't make them more engaged with politics. Many low-information voters would just fill in the blanks on the ballot sheet without a clue as to whom they were supporting. Unwilling voters do not make for a better democracy. But in a true democracy, a majority of citizens should determine who runs the country, said Matt Steinglass in Economist.com. What right does a government have to pass laws governing behavior, jail people when they break them, or tax people's income if it has not made participation in voting as widespread as possible? Maybe Oregon has a workable alternative, said Francis Berry in BloombergView.com. Everyone there with a driver's license is now automatically enrolled as a voter. Those who wish to remain unregistered can opt out, but the onus is on them. No one's choice is taken away, but registering to vote becomes painless. It makes perfect sense, unless, that is, you'd prefer that most citizens not vote. Also on the Talking Points page, football, quitting to avoid brain damage. What am I doing? NFL linebacker Chris Borland said to himself. Is this how I'm going to live my adult life? Banging my head, especially with what I've learned and know about the dangers? What Borland learned by doing some research, said the New York Times in an editorial, was that the game's repetitive head trauma could leave him gravely and permanently damaged. So after just one season as a bruising 248-pound linebacker for the San Francisco 49ers, Borland, 24, quit, leaving behind a dream career that promised fame and immense fortune. It is both a brave and a smart decision, said Dave Zirin in TheNation.com. Brain injuries from repeated concussions have left thousands of former players racked with debilitating headaches, anger, and confusion, and the league itself admits that more than one-third of players will suffer early-onset dementia. History shows that playing NFL football is like playing Russian roulette. Will other players now follow Borland's lead and choose to put the gun down? I envy Chris Borland, said John Urschel in ThePlayersTribune.com. As an offensive lineman for the Baltimore Ravens, I am fully aware that playing in the NFL can't possibly help your long-term mental health. And with a degree in mathematics and numerous published papers in major mathematical journals, I'm not without other options. But I play because I'm addicted to the rush that comes when you lay everything on the line and physically dominate the player across from you. Some fans may have an existential crisis watching gladiators sacrificing their future to deliver crushing tackles, said Andrew Sharp in Grantland.com. But this year's Super Bowl broke ratings records, and football remains immensely popular. Plenty of players will gladly take Borland's job. Risks be damned. But for how long, said Thomas Boswell in the Washington Post. Studies show that repeated blows to the head at any age can lead to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, and that those most likely to develop it started playing football early in life. The NFL's future draftees are now playing high school football, and they all need signed permission slips from home. With parents now realizing that the NFL's billions in wealth is built on decades of human wreckage, how many signatures will they get? And we've got time for a few notes as we wind down the hour. San Francisco has the highest concentration of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in the nation, with 6.2% of residents identifying as LGBT. Portland, Oregon is second with 5.4% of the residents, and Austin is third with 5.3%. Mormon stronghold Salt Lake City is seventh at 4.7%, ahead of New York City at 4%. Americans are expected to spend roughly $9 billion illegally gambling on the NCAA tournament this year, significantly more than the $3.7 billion spent to influence the 2014 midterm elections. But the March Madness total was bet by roughly 40 million people, or 12.6% of the nation's population, whereas only 0.2% of Americans made contributions to the 2014 elections. Despite the fears of modern parents, children today are much safer than they were two decades ago. The physical abuse of children declined by 55% between 1992 and 2011, while sexual abuse declined 64%. From 1997 to 2012, abductions by strangers also went down by 51%. Since taking office, President Obama, who prefers the golf course to the woods, has visited the presidential country retreat at Camp David only 35 times, spanning 86 days. At this point in his presidency, George W. Bush had visited Camp David 119 times, covering 375 days. 49% of Americans think that standardized testing in schools has done more harm than good. 20% think it's done more good, and 31% aren't sure. And a quote for you from Mel Brooks. He says, "Bad taste is simply saying the truth before it should be said." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.